Hello, podcast listeners. A quick notice before we get started on today's episode of Emperors of Rome. Rhiannon and I will be recording a Q&A episode. We need your cues in order to A. I think that's how that works. So if you have any questions on a Roman topic that you have a burning desire to be answered, now is the moment that you can grasp. You can send us a tweet on Twitter. You can send us a message on Facebook. I'll have a link pinned to my Twitter account that gives you a little form that you can fill in. Or, for those who want bonus points, you can use your phone, record your question yourself, and email it to emperorspodcast@gmail.com. That way, if we like it, we can have you yourself asking the question. Support the podcast, do it right now, I'll wait. And after that, enjoy Emperors of Rome. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University. This is episode CLXXVIII, Witches in Roman Literature. Romans had the reality of witches, those who made the brews and prepared the curses, but also the witches of fiction. In their poems and stories, a witch took on a horrific persona, one that skews much more closely to the modern idea of a witch. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Canidia, her unkempt hair bound with slender snakes, orders fig trees to be uprooted from tombs. She orders funereal cypress and a feather and eggs from a nocturnal streaks, smeared with the blood of a hideous frog, and herbs that Iolcos and Hyberia, fertile in poisons, send forth, and bones snatched from the mouth of a starving hound. All of these she orders to be burned in Colchian flames. Horace, Epode 5, lines 15 to 28.
That's me snapping.
Why?
Because that's how you applaud poetry.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's too trendy for me.
Well read. Unpack that for me. That sounds a bit more closer to witchiness than what we've talked about in the previous episode of Roman witches. So this is a literary witch that Horace is writing about.
Yes. So this is a poem from 30 BCE. People who've read Horace probably haven't read this kind of Horace.
Yeah.
He's much more... His odes are the famous poems, and we get lines like the idea of live today because tomorrow you might be dead, drink lots of good wine, be grateful to Augustus. There's lots of patriotic stuff in there. Whereas this, the epodes, are an early group of poems that have some of this spooky stuff, some more obscene stuff, not things we associate with Horace usually. So here we've got Canidia. She is named. Her name's interesting because it's perhaps a reminder of the word canis, which means dog in Latin. She's got unkempt hair. And I think right from the start, we see a more Roman version of the witch here that is sort of a hag. I use that word advisedly. So it tends to be older, tends to be undesirable in Roman eyes. That's distinct from the Greek literary witch who tends, and I will say tends, to be more goddess-like, like Circe, like Medea, who are young and attractive and seductresses as well. As we'll see with Canidia, she's a loser in love, and this is thrown at her. You know, she doesn't seem to have children. She's not fertile. So she's got all of these things attached to her that associate her with the kind of old Roman hag and the suspicion of older women generally.
So a lot more supernatural than in Roman poetry than was the realistic, kind of more grounded Roman life kind of witch.
Yeah, I mean, there's some overlap.
One will influence the other and the perception. I guess that's your overlap, really.
Yeah, but I think here in literary accounts, not always, but often poetic, we've got this figure who is she's a bit more like a sort of fury, a supernatural, hellish presence. That's certainly what the unkempt hair bound with snakes. So snakes in the hair might either remind you of mythological women like Medusa, you know, the Gorgon who can turn people to stone, or this group called the Furies, who in Roman literature you might think most of Alecto, who comes from Virgil's Aeneid, who throws snakes at Aeneas's enemy Turnus to infect him with the desire for war. These creatures that kind of raise passion in people or drive them to madness. And that's what she looks like, at least. She's got this association with monstrous females just because of her hair. So from the very first couple of lines I read out. And she's associated with graveyards. This is something we see with Roman witches, with death, with nighttime. All right, the funereal cypresses, cypress trees associated with graveyards. And she's making some kind of potion with weird stuff. All right, a feather and eggs from, I didn't translate it because it's a bit untranslatable, a nocturnal streak. Yeah, it's an owl of some sort. And that word strix is close to that Latin word striga, which is the word that we translated as witch in our podcast on witches. So for the Romans, it's never quite clear whether strix is a bird or a witch in the guise of a bird. Those two words are associated with one another by them. It is a bit like what is found in Germanicus's room, that this feather and egg are smeared with blood from not just any frog, but a hideous frog, and these unspecified herbs. And where do they come from? They come from Iolcos, which is in northern Greece, Thessaly, very much associated with witches in the Roman mind and the Greek mind too. And it has a connection with Medea. So we've got all these places and these substances brought together to make her spell. And the one I like most is, the one that is most striking, I think, is the bone snatched from the mouth of a starving hound. Because as we'll see, this spell, this potion she's making is going to be all about desire, tantalizing. It can't just be any bones. They have to have been bones that were desired and then taken away. So this poor dog continues to starve. And she burns them together. And she burns them in Colchian flames. Colchis is where Medea comes from. So she's got all of these things wrapped together in her spell, all of these allusions to witches from elsewhere and different traditions. She's actually got two other witches with her. They form a triad, which makes it very Macbeth-like, the three witches.
Yeah.
But she's the main one. She's got two others helping out called Sagana and Vea. Just to add to the fact that night and darkness are what she, in particular, Cnidia, but also witches are associated with, she calls on Night and Diana, Nox et Diana, to help her. And so Night as in the goddess Night, so capital N, and Diana because she is often conflated with Hecate, who is the goddess of magic and witchcraft. She's called Diana and Night, who preside over the silent time when mystic rites are performed. So we're very definitely getting what we really didn't get with witch poisoners in the so-called real world. I guess they were sort of doing the dark arts, but now these witches do their business at night, which is a scarier time, as we know.
Okay, so it feels like there's a bit of a ritual involved in this. So what are the witches making? What are their intentions?
Well, their intentions are malevolent. And you're right, ritual and rites are happening here and are mentioned here. This is very much one of those inversions of ritual that we get elsewhere, because we've got rituals happening all the time in the Roman world and sacrifices and pouring of libations and prayer. But this is negative. This is, and to quote again, turn your divinity and anger against my enemy's house. So this is getting at somebody she no longer likes. So straight away we see this is a dangerous woman. We're going to see how very much more dangerous she is. She is making a spell in order to get her revenge on somebody and also to bind them to her. What she's doing this for, in fact, as we learn, is to make a love potion. So she's making a love charm. So it's kind of a weird sort of revenge to win back a former lover who's called Varus. He doesn't seem that appealing, actually. He's hanging out with the sex workers of Rome's less salubrious district, the Subura, so where the poor live. I think it's meant to be a marker of her desperation that one critic has described him as being aged and overly perfumed, that she wants this man back.
Oh, look, the heart wants what it wants.
She's already tried this. So in line with Poisoners not always being successful, Canidia has previously been unsuccessful. And she thinks this is just because the woman who won him over is also a witch. And she's just got more powerful spell going on.
All right. So there's a little bit of desperation here, which might imply why she needs her coven with her.
Yeah. Why she needs her coven and also why she needs this really despicable spell. I should say we're going on to talk about really nasty stuff, including abduction of a child and torturing him, because that's what she's been doing now. These plants, blood and bones are a kind of side menu here. Canidia and her witches have taken a child, they've abducted him. He's a freeborn Roman boy, which is very clear in this poem and makes it much worse to the Roman reader because he should be protected.
Yeah.
And his body parts are actually going to provide the potent spell for Canidia. So she's going to starve him to death. She's going to apply this potion and then she's going to use his body parts in the potion that will win back her lover.
Mm.
So the poem continues straight from the last long quote that I read and we get one of the other witches, Vea. Vea, unrestrained by any sense of guilt, groans with exertion as she digs up the earth with a firm mattock so that the boy, buried in the pit, can be starved to death in sight of a meal that is renewed two or three times a day, while only his head projects from the earth like a swimmer whose chin just emerges from the water. She does this so that his dried liver and bone marrow can be made into a love potion just as soon as his pupils, fixed on the forbidden food, have melted away.
Mm. So it sounds like the intent is part of that. You know, it needs to be this cruel for the potion, for the magic to be effective and powerful.
Yeah, it makes sense of the bones taken from the starving dog now. Yeah. We need to have that tantalizing going on in order for the spell to be powerful. So there needs to be this torture, this desire, this kind of capturing of desire, I think is what is meant to be happening here, that then she can transfer that desire to her lover, her ex-lover, and he will desire her, presumably. We don't find out in the poem whether she is successful. I don't like to use that word, but yeah.
Mm.
It's a spell that's meant to encourage desire and longing. You know, this boy has been abducted, and what I mentioned earlier, the screech owl, the Strix, is also part of this kind of world because the Romans thought of them as creatures who might abduct, who might snatch children. Owls, they snatch their prey, don't they? So it makes a sort of sense.
Mm.
The definition we have in the dictionary is a screech owl, which according to the belief of the ancients, sucked the blood of young children, superstitiously regarded as a vampire or a harpy. Now, vampirism, as we think of it, is a much later concept, but this seems to be an early form of that. And it's an owl, so you think, well, it's not, you know, we think of vampires as in human form. But as I say, there seems to be some slippage between the Strix, the screech owl, and the witch figure, as if almost they can slip between the two forms. We've got some indication of the child snatcher Strix in Ovid, because we always have to come back to Ovid, in his poem Fasti in book 6, lines 133 to 40, where he says, there are insatiable birds, not the harpies. So despite what I just read out from the dictionary, he's very insistent they're not the harpies that deprived Phineas of his feasts. This is from Greek myth. The harpies come down and snatch his food, again, depriving someone of food. Although it is from them that they descend. The screech owl, the Strix, is related to the harpies. And then he describes them. He says, their heads are large, their eyes unblinking, their beaks made for hunting. Their wings are white, their talons hooked. At night they fly and seek out children separated from their nurses to snatch them from their cradles and rend their bodies. They are said to tear out children's milky entrails with their beaks and fill their gullets with the blood that they have drunk. There is a name for these birds, striges, so called because of their strident shrieking in the night. We should not take Ovid as his word that that's the derivation. He likes to give us nice etymologies that are more
convenient to accurate.
Exactly.
Okay. These examples that we're reading out seem to be relatively cruel to children.
Very.
So are they designed to frighten children, or are they designed to frighten the parents of children?
I think frighten the parents.
Yeah.
Although I guess a cruel parent or guardian might suggest if you're not good, the screech owl might come for you.
Well, you know, who hasn't done that?
some parenting tips to take from this podcast. It's very clearly about fear of loss of a child. Aimed at makes it just sound nasty and malicious, but that it comes from the fears of child abduction or maybe just losing, you know, so many children die in infancy, losing them in that way, that it's not surprising that this is made explicit in these sound like folktale type origins that have been made more sophisticated in this poetry, I suppose.
Yeah, but when you're using this sort of poetry and literature to formulate what people might perceive a witch to be, that can then be applied to the little old lady who lives at the end of the market that everyone's a bit suspicious of because she's a bit gross.
That's certainly what we're used to from, say, the witch trials in medieval Europe or in Salem. Mm. And I think there's a similar kind of dynamic going on here, that these women who are, maybe they're widowed, maybe they're just not married, that they are implicated here. Therefore, there's a potential for them to be associated with this screech owl, this Strix, and the damage that's done to a family, the loss of a child. And this is the way it's often read. The Strix, you know, it's a female bird. Not all Latin animal names are female, but the Strix is. There must have been male screech owls, but they don't exist grammatically.
Yeah.
And the Striga, that's a female word as well, a feminine word. But both of them really represent this kind of upside down, this inversion of femininity, or the stereotype of femininity that you give birth to and nurture children. They steal them away and tear them apart. So it's not surprising that Canidia the witch demands the eggs and feather from the nocturnal Strix, because that is a powerful bird for her. It's got this power of snatching away, of abduction, that she wants to harness, which she kind of already has through abducting this boy. We very strongly get the backlash to Canidia from the boy himself, who gets to speak out and says that she is acting out of sexual jealousy. She didn't get to keep her lover. You're a failed woman kind of idea. And you have no children. I know you have no children. He's kind of taunting her with being a failed woman in Roman terms. But she's disrupted this other household to try and complete her own.
Yeah.
So that suggests to us that suspicion of childless or older women.
All right, so you've said that we don't know if she was successful with this potion / magic that she was trying to do to win back her lover, but how does the poem end?
It ends kind of on a bit of a knife edge, a cliffhanger, I guess you'd say. The boy gives as good as he gets at the end, or as much as he can while buried up to the neck. He stops begging and he says to her, "I'm going to come back as a vengeful fury. The town will take out its revenge on you. They'll stone you to death." So he kind of has this prophecy. "Your corpses are going to be torn apart by wild animals," he says. So again, that's justifiable given what they're intending to do to dismember him, that they'll receive the same kind of lack of respect for their body. Very important to the Greeks and the Romans that there be respect for the body after death. So they're going to get this brutal fate as well, if he's right. But we don't know. It ends abruptly.
Yeah.
Which is deliberate, all right? This is not, Horace lived a long time after this. This is not something he left a draft of. He published it as is. I don't hold out much hope for that boy surviving, but hopefully he's right in context. And
he might get his revenge in this life or the next.
Mm.
That's Horace. Let's turn to another text, shall we? You've got down here Petronius. Who was he and what was the context that he was writing under?
So Petronius wrote a novel called The Satyricon, which we have fragments of, but we have some significant fragments, and it's a kind of adventure tale, not a noble adventure, of these three characters. The main one's called Encolpius, who kind of go on these travels. Encolpius actually falls victim to some kind of witchcraft and is made impotent. So his journey is to try and get his potency back. That's not actually what I'm really going to talk about here, but you can see witches can be very powerful in that way.
What a noble quest for a book.
It's
It sounds like, you know, Ye Olde Hangover, one of those movies.
Yeah, in more highbrow terms, it's often seen as a sort of picaresque novel, which is how I describe the Apuleius novel.
Yes.
As well, this series of adventures that happen to not to a highborn character at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of stumbling around Campania, so in southern Italy, and they come to a dinner put on by a really rich freedman called Trimalchio, who's very vulgar. I've probably talked about him before somewhere.
I'm not too sure. I want to hear more, but off we go.
We should talk about him at some point because Petronius was part of the inner circle of the Emperor Nero.
Is this a real guy, is it?
I'm sure we've talked about him, Matt, because he falls victim to in the Pisonian conspiracy and is told to kill himself.
Ah.
So he dies in 66 CE.
Okay.
And Trimalchio, who's kind of really satirized in this novel as rich but vulgar, is sometimes seen as a parody of Nero. So let's do an episode on Trimalchio.
So you shouldn't criticize Nero in contemporary texts, but it's quite fine for you to make fun of his friend under the context of, you know, this might be a kind of Nero persona.
Well, yeah, I mean, Trimalchio means triple king in Greek. And
and that just writes itself.
but as I say, plenty of people who don't think that. Okay, so having given all that background, Trimalchio and his other almost all equally vulgar freedman friends, like this is very top-down view of ex-slaves, there's no doubt about that. They are at this dinner, they start telling each other horror stories, basically scary stories. There's just been one about a werewolf, which is really interesting, but we're not going to talk about it here. And then Trimalchio gets up and says, oh, that was a great story, but let me tell you one about witches, about a striga, strigae. This is the main source for that word. As I said, it's not used very often, the word that actually means witches.
So he gets to tell a story within a story.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we get, a series of these.
Very Tarantino-esque.
Tarantino took so much from literature of this period, I think, if only he knew. So we didn't get the word striga in the Canidia poem, in the Horace poem. Because it's very uncommon, but we do see it here. And let me read out a bit of this story. Trimalchio says, now I'll tell you a hair raiser myself, building it up. Though I'm like a jackass on a slippery pavement compared to him, so my story's not going to be quite as good, he says.
Not as good as the werewolf story.
When I was a long-haired boy, this means he was young and a slave, for I lived a Chian life from my youth up, which means a life of luxury. Leisure anyway. My master's love boy, or boy love, so this is his slave, who's his kind of sex slave.
Yeah.
He died. He was a jewel. By Hercules, he was perfect in every way. While his sorrow-stricken mother was bewailing his loss, and the rest of us were lamenting with her, the witches suddenly began to screech so loudly that you would have thought a hare was being run down by the hounds. At that time, we had a Cappadocian slave. The Cappadocians are supposed to be tough. He was tall, very bold, and he had muscle too. He could hold a mad bull in the air. He wrapped a mantle around his left arm, boldly rushed out of doors with drawn sword, and ran a woman through the middle, about here. And then Trimalchio superstitiously says, let there be no harm to what I touch. This idea that the story could come back to harm him. So he touches his tummy. We heard a scream, but as a matter of fact, I won't lie to you, we didn't catch sight of the witches themselves. Our idiot, that's the Cappadocian, came back presently and threw himself upon the bed. His whole body was black and blue, as if he'd been flogged with whips. And of course, the reason of that was that she had touched him with her evil hand. We shut the door and returned to our business. But when the mother put her arms around the body of her son, it turned out it was only a straw bolster. No heart, no guts, nothing. Of course, the witches had swooped down upon the lad and put the straw changeling in the place. Believe me or not, suit yourselves, but I say there are women that know too much. And night hags, too. And they turn everything upside down. And as for the long-haired idiot, that's the Cappadocian, he never got back his own natural colour, and he died raving mad a few days later. That is Satyricon, chapter 63.
All right, so that's a fictional story within the fictional story. We should kind of point that out.
It is. And we should also point out that some commentators have mentioned, the supernatural part aside, there are problems with it, with its sense, because Trimalchio says we couldn't see the witches, no one could see the witches.
Yeah.
But he knows where the guy struck them. struck them around the middle. So it doesn't make any sense. And so that may be part of the satire of Trimalchio.
Right. So a boy dies and a slave rushes off and skewers a woman and comes back cursed.
Yeah.
A lot going on.
Beaten up and dies a few days later and with all of his senses gone.
Mm.
And they've abducted the body. This time it's not a living boy, but the implication, I think, is that they have use for the body parts. They've left something else in its place. And I think it's the ending that's particularly significant here, that these are women who know too much. He actually makes up a word for this. He uses plus, which means more, and skiai, which means knowing in the feminine.
Mm.
This idea that, you know, these women are out of place. They've gained this expertise, this knowledge, but it's too much. It's wrong. And they're nocturnal as well. They're nocturni, night hags. And they invert everything. They turn everything upside down. So they turn the corpse into just a outline of straw. They turn this very bold, powerful man into this raving lunatic who dies covered in bruises. And they're invisible. They're really powerful, but we can't see them. So we can't do anything about them. And they snatch children.
Yeah. Okay. So that's very much a kind of metaphysical witch. It's a fear of the witch without them being directly involved. Is there any examples where they take a more direct role in the action?
Yeah, I mean, these witches are nameless, aren't they? They're just a kind of, look.
It's the fear of the witch that you're hearing about.
Yeah,
exactly. And what they're capable of and what they're doing.
Yeah, so it's a bit different to Canidia there, and also to the last example that we can't really leave witches without talking about a contemporary of Petronius, who's called Lucan, who's a relative of the younger Seneca. Also part of Nero's court, also caught in the Pisonian conspiracy and had to kill himself. He wrote a poem known variously as the Pharsalia or the Civil War, which is about the war between Caesar and Pompey. And in book six, he has a character go to see a witch who's called Erichtho. It's Sextus Pompey, Pompey's son, who goes to see her to find out about the future. So he wants a prophecy. What will happen? Will his side win? Will his family fare well?
Yeah.
And she is, I would say she's much more like the literary witch of the Greeks in some ways, or she borrows from them. But she is also described as disgusting in various ways. She's Thessalian, so that's where they are. They're in northern Greece at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And broadly, the outline of this is that she makes her prophecy not just by seeing the future and prophesying it. The way she can do it is by making a concoction. And she uses this to reanimate a corpse from the battlefield. Commentators go in, try to contort themselves in all kinds of ways by saying the battle hasn't happened yet. So where does this battlefield corpse come from? But anyway, there's a corpse.
There's many a battlefield at that time. I'm quite sure that she'd be able to find one.
Because this is just before the Battle of Pharsalia.
Yeah.
She reanimates this battlefield corpse so that the corpse, the soldier, can tell what is going to happen.
Okay.
So he is brought back to life. And for this, she has the stuff about she has to find a corpse whose lungs aren't damaged so that he can speak.
Which, oh, nice touch. Yeah.
Quite amusing in this horrific story. And so she gets these potions together. I'll talk about those in a second, which are then inserted into the body. And the body then comes back to life to tell the future and then has to be killed again.
Okay.
It's lovely stuff.
All right, so this is ye olde zombie.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's zombie-like. It's been described as a ghost, but yeah, there are certainly zombie connotations here. Okay, so this is in book six of Lucan, and it's a longish passage if you read the whole account. But I would say it starts around, well, if you want to start with Sextus Pompey deciding to do this, then you start around line 420 in book six.
Mm-hmm.
Sextus, son unworthy of his parent Magnus, as he's described.
Oh, harsh.
Prowling as an exile in Scylla's waves. And so fear goaded him to know ahead of time fate's course. I'm reading this from a really good translation by Sue Braund, which I recommend. So he goes and searches and finds this Thessalian witch she's described as. And she is, we'll find out, she's called Erichtho. And we get this description of their power, the power of these witches. So a kind of more generic one before we get to Erichtho specifically. By witches' spells, love not brought by fate glides into hardened hearts. So there's a bit of a connection back to Canidia.
The love poetry.
Force people to fall in love with you.
Love poetry, sorry.
Yeah, that was a love poem. Send that to your wife on Valentine's Day.
Love potion, sorry.
There is power not only in their harmful cups, so potions, or when they steal the promise, swelling with the forehead's juice of mother's love. So again, danger to mother and child is implied. Mm. Minds polluted by no decay of drawn off poison or destroyed, charmed out by spells. The fact that minds are mentioned there reminds me a little bit of what happened to the Cappadocian in Petronius's story.
Mm.
Goes on to describe all the various things that they can bring about. They can stop the sun. The racing universe is paralyzed once the spell is heard. And as Jupiter drives on the sky on its speedy axles, he's amazed that it does not move.
Mm.
So they can stop time. That's pretty cool. Sometimes they drench everywhere with rains and muffle burning Phoebus with clouds. They can change the weather and you don't see the sun anymore. That's Phoebus. And heaven thunders without Jupiter knowing. So they can kind of do stuff that goes above what the gods can do. So
yeah.
This is really, really powerful, according to Lucan. He says also that the gods basically fear them, fear their words, and can't overcome them. So a very lengthy passage about the power of witches.
So it gives you a good bit of context then and get backstory about witches.
Yes,
but,
exactly.
But
so.
What does it tell you about the witch that's doing this spell, Erichtho, and what she's doing for Sextus Pompey?
She's someone who hangs around burial grounds and she deals specifically with bringing corpses back. So when dead bodies are preserved in stone, i.e. they're buried in a tomb, she greedily vents her rage on the entire corpse. This is one of the nastiest quotes I've read from Roman literature. She sinks her hands into the eyes. She gleefully digs out the cold eyeballs and gnaws the pallid nails on withered hand.
Wow.
So she's got withered hand. I know it's that might be a detail that we miss in all the disgusting stuff she's doing.
Yeah.
But she's old and haggard.
Yeah.
So very much in the Roman witch tradition there. With her own mouth, she has burst the noose and knots of the criminal. Criminal corpse is often seen as quite powerful. Mangled bodies as they hung, scraped clean the crosses, so taking bodies from crucifix, torn guts beaten by the rains, marrows exposed and baked by the sun. She has stolen the iron driven into hands.
Yeah, nailed them.
And black and putrid liquid trickling through the limbs and the congealed slime. And if muscle resisted her bite, she has tugged with all her weight.
Oh, Lucan's seen a corpse or two in his time by the sounds of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That is the part that I wrote yuck in the margin to.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's around line 538 onwards. Just a little bit later, 554, nor do her hands refrain from murder. I mean, by the time you're stripping corpses off a crucifix and biting at them, I'm not sure it can get much worse, but she actually carries out murders. And this is the worst part from my point of view. So through a wound in the belly, not nature's exit, the fetus is extracted to be put on burning altars. So she snatches a fetus from the womb to use in her spells. She plucks from young men's faces the bloom of cheek and from a dying boy cuts off a lock of hair with her left hand.
Again, left, sinister.
Yeah, exactly. Again, there seems to be a lot of power in a young boy's body, or body parts, or in this case, just his hair. So, and that, you know, I could have read a lot more, which is equally powerful. This
yuck.
Is quite, it's yuck, and but it's very typical of Lucan in its really powerful invocation of a scene. I recommend anyone to read Lucan. It's kind of dramatic, terrifying stuff. You know, one of the theories as to why Lucan had to be killed is that Nero was really jealous of how good his poetry was.
Yeah, well. So going back to Sextus Pompey and the creation of a zombie, what is she doing for him precisely?
Well, she says to him, I can't change the future, but I can tell you what it is. I don't know if Pompey had exactly asked for that. She says, we the throng of Thessaly admit fortune is the stronger. All right, we can't change fortune. But if you're content to learn events in advance, paths to truth, both many and easy, will open up for us. So we've got that power to tell the future. So she searches around the battlefield, and at last a corpse is chosen, one with the pierced breast and is dragged along, a hook sunk in the dead man's rope. The poor cadaver over rocks and stones is hauled to live again. It is placed below the high cliff of the hollow mountain, which ghastly Erichtho had condemned to her rites. So she selects the corpse, as I say, lungs intact.
Mm-hmm.
She has to be dressed right for it.
Okay.
And she gets associated with the Furies here, those powerful demonic forces. With a Fury's crazed robes of many hues, she garbs herself. Uncovered is her face and locks pulled back. Her bristling hair is bound with wreaths of vipers. Sounds a bit Canidia-like as well, the binding of the hair with snakes.
Very ritualistic.
Mm. Yeah. And again, it's that kind of inverted ritual that we're seeing here. So this is what she actually does. Ready for this. She makes a big announcement about how if she could, she'd bring back the monsters of mythology. But what she actually does is she opens up the corpse's chest with fresh wounds. With boiling blood, she fills it. From the innards, washes off the gore and applies generous doses of lunar poisons, whatever they are. Stuff she's collected when the moon's out, maybe. So this is a kind of witch's brew. With this is mixed whatever nature spawns misbegotten. Here is the froth of rabid dogs. Here the entrails of the lynx. Here the hump of dire hyena and the marrow of the snake-fed stag. Here is the remora, detainer of the ship mid-sea. This is a fish that the ancients thought was like would sort of suck on ships and stop it from going forth.
Okay, yeah.
Though you restrain the rigging. That's the wind blows it, but it doesn't go. And dragon's eyes. And stones which sound when warmed beneath a breeding bird. And here is the Arab's flying serpent and the viper born in the Red Sea, the guardian of the precious oyster shell, the cast skin of the still-living horned snake of Libya, and the ashes of the phoenix burnt upon the eastern altar. Ashes from the phoenix. How did she get that? She's got access.
Yeah, really. But this strikes me as a bit of, you know, I'm throwing ingredients in here, but it's also double, toil and trouble. Yeah. You know, these are the incantations that I'm saying at the same time.
Yeah, it is very reminiscent of what we're more familiar with from Macbeth and that ilk, isn't it? All of these weird ingredients. We had a bit of that with Canidia, but here, like a lot of Lucan, it's driven to extremes. I think the phoenix is part of the extreme because it's so rare.
Yeah.
To these she added common poisons, so he's admitting that that's not common, and put in leaves drenched in spells unspeakable, and herbs her foul mouth spat on at their birth, and venoms of her own creation. And then she talks. Last comes her voice, bewitching the gods of Lethe, it's the underworld river, more portently than any drug, first compounded of jumbled noises, jarring, utterly discordant with human speech. The bark of dogs, the howls of wolves, the owl's cry of alarm, and the screech owl's nighttime moan. So we get our streaks in there. The wild beasts shriek and wail, the serpents hiss. It utters too the beating of the cliff-smashed wave, the sounds of forests and the thunderings of the fissured clouds. So all of nature, all the noises of nature, nasty noises, basically, get buried in there. Then she speaks in Haemonian incantation and pierces Tartarus, that's the underworld, with the utterance thus. I invoke the Eumenides, those are the Furies, Hell's Horror, and the Avengers. I invoke chaos, eager to disorder countless worlds. I invoke the ruler of the earth, tormented for long future ages by the drawn-out death of the gods. So she's basically saying, I'm foreseeing the future when Jupiter is going to be in torment. It's a bold statement. I invoke the Styx, underworld river, and the Elysian fields. No witch of Thessaly may reach. I invoke Persephone. And she goes on with a long invocation of all these people who are going to help her see the future. Now, I have to say, after all of this, the actual prophecy takes very few lines. So clearly what Lucan's interested in is the gore and the horror and the spells.
So the destination isn't the point, it's how you get there.
Yeah. Do you want to know what she does tell him there?
It's the friends we make along the way. Yeah, go ahead.
She basically says, well, you might have guessed because, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, which Lucan had too.
You're not going to win.
It's not looking good for your family.
Maybe don't go to Pharsalus.
She mentions all these places, but she's very vague about them. Like she mentions Asia and Africa. You know, she mentions vague places and says members of your family are going to die there, die in the places conquered by Rome.
Mm-hmm.
It's ironic because Pompey himself had conquered many of these places. Unhappy men, be in dread of Europe, Libya, Asia. Fortune has distributed your graves between your triumphs. So you conquered these places, you're going to die in them. Oh, pitiable house. So looks really bad for you, Sextus. This is not going to make you feel good as you go off.
It does. It really kind of wraps up the family, this war.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a long prophecy, but remember, it's not her talking.
It's the corpse talking.
It's the corpse talking.
Yeah.
And the corpse was very reluctant at first, but she kind of forced it into it. It says a little earlier, make haste to die. You know, go down from tombs, however small, and trample upon the shades of the gods of Rome.
Mm.
The question is, whose grave Nile and whose Tiber will lap? Yeah, it looks really dark for all of you, is what the corpse tells. The book finishes very quickly with Erichtho burning the corpse to kill it again.
Okay. Well, you don't want a vengeful corpse that you've risen from the dead.
We get the impression that the corpse wants to die again, to be honest. Finally permitting him to die is the phrase.
Yeah, okay. Erichtho seems horrible in this, just, you know, a real hag of a witch. But also, dare I say, respected in her arts, in her skills. It's nice to see a witch with a specialisation as well. This is one who's skilled particularly in raising the dead and hangs around the cemeteries, which is a bit different from, you know, you wouldn't go to this witch for a love potion, would you?
Well, it did say that witches in general have that power, so maybe she can dabble in that too. But of course, this is a very specific context and...
You'd want her to wash her hands first.
Part of the horror that's being sought out here is that this is kind of the ultimate breaking of boundaries, because we've seen witches act in ways that Roman women shouldn't. She's breaking the boundary between life and death.
Yeah.
So that's a huge taboo. And she is allowing knowledge of the future through this. She has to get hold of all of these really forbidden substances, really hard to get, but awful substances in order to do it. And the corpse itself, I felt I'd read out enough, but, you know, the corpse is quite reluctant to come back. It's not something that the dead want to do. They want to stay there. And the corpse also tells of a kind of civil war going on in the underworld. It's often seen as an inversion of what Virgil does in the Aeneid, where he has Aeneas's father prophesy the great future for Rome.
Mm.
Lucan has Erichtho's corpse prophesy doom and destruction for Pompey's family specifically.
So I find it interesting how different this witch is from the Petronius witch.
Mm.
The Petronius witch seems a lot more screech owl and a bit of a myth, a bit of a threat.
Mm.
I mean, it all happens off camera, whereas this one is a much more grounded old lady witch. This is a lot more of the witch that we associate with witchcraft.
Yeah, I think so. And I do think that Lucan is drawing to a certain extent on Greek literary tradition, although he does have her as an old hag. So he's also drawing on the Furies and the Electo type terrifying demon-like figure.
Yeah.
She's very, very powerful, but she kind of has a personality, I suppose, as opposed to those anonymous witches in Petronius. I think she's by far the most powerful of the literary witches that we see in those three examples. She's really terrifying. But overall, we can kind of come back to the sad conclusion that in all of these figures, you can see writ large. I mean, these are three male writers, and they're drawing on this really ill feeling towards women, this misogyny that shows this fear of these powerful women, what they can do. They will harm young boys. They will harm men. They will know too much. Even Erichtho perhaps knows too much. We get that absolutely stated in Petronius, the pluskiai, the women who know too much.
That's Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic. And thanks for listening.